Welcome, everyone, to the brand new podcast, The Reformed Fringe. I am your host, Doug Van Dorn, and with me is John Moffat. We are two pastors, and we are starting a new rebranding of Kingdoms Unveiled to tell you about the fringy world that's out there. John, why did we want to rebrand this thing?
Well, I think it helps explain a little bit more what we're doing, right? We wanted to talk about the kingdom, but we also wanted to say that there's more to talk about. And we thought that the Reformed Fringe was, first of all, we have a community based on it, but we also thought that it was a good way to describe what we're doing. And I didn't even tell you I was going to do this, but I want to talk about that word fringe for a minute, because it's kind of like the word conspiracy theory.
Oh, yeah.
And we just throw it out there as it's like a negative. Listen, for all of time, since the Reformed faith began, Reformers are fringe people. Let's define the word first. Like, Doug, what does the word fringe mean? So maybe we can all understand and agree on how this word should be used.
Fringe is one of the greatest television shows there has ever been. Okay. Did you watch it?
Oh, dude, and I can't find it. I'd love to watch it again.
It is so good. Yeah, John Noble's character, where he plays Walter Bishop, literally my favorite character in all of TV.
Yeah, and it just keeps going wilder and wilder. And I'm not going to tell you about the TV show, but if you can find it, it's worth watching.
But so what is the fringe? I mean, fringe is something that's on the outskirts.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. So when you think about the Reformers, we've never been the predominant movement. There's always been on the outskirts of theology. And during certain periods of time, like during the Enlightenment, during the explosion of evolution, Reformers kept fighting for the supernatural nature of our faith. We wanted to talk about the literal miracles that the text was teaching us to believe in, a real resurrection, that salvation is through a supernatural means, and the gospel is not men coming to God, but God's power bringing men to himself. It is the power of God. So everything surrounding Reformed theology is fringe. And this is why I think it's appropriate to call this podcast the Reformed Fringe Podcast, because we are both very much appreciative and dedicated to the Reformed faith. We are both Reformed Baptist pastors who would hold to the creeds and confessions. We think they're extremely helpful. And at the same time, we're wanting to put the fringe back in Reform, man. That should be the tagline, putting the fringe back in Reform.
It's funny when you think about what liberalism was when the German liberals came around in the 19th century. What did they do? They gutted the scripture of the miracles. It was kind of they came on top of a guy like Thomas Jefferson and the deists that were really doing that even before they were. Sure. So you de-supernaturalize the text, or if you're Jefferson, you literally cut out the miracles out of your New Testament physically with a scissors. I always wondered how that worked on the other side, like, because was the Bible not like a double-sided text?
He must have had like a single print.
I never understood that, but, you know, so what was a liberal?
Well, you know, there's an illustration there, Doug. That's actually a brilliant when you think about it, because if you don't realize what else
you're
is
cutting
going with
out
it.
Other stuff that you don't want to cut out. Right. I'm only supposed to be cutting out the miracles, because I don't believe that that's possible.
That's right.
And it's just so wild that liberalism, what makes it liberalism? Well, it's an experiential based, me-centered theology that guts theology of especially the supernatural aspects of the text. Sure. And, you know, the only things that are supernatural in this world are not just God and the devil. There's a whole bunch of other stuff there, and they didn't like any of it. Well, we as evangelicals and even as Reformed people, we interact with liberals. We knee jerk overreact with liberals. You know, I think about like the fundamentalist movement of the 19 teens and 20s and stuff like that, which was kind of a strange making of the bed with reform people and fundamentalists and even legalistic people, because they were all saw a real problem with the liberals as they were fighting against the very things that we talk about on the show. But you know, you end up when you fight against somebody, you can end up actually implicitly taking some of the things on that are characteristics of the very people that you fight.
Yep.
And, you know, we kind of think that that has happened to one degree or another.
Yeah.
So we're trying to counter that.
Yeah. And maybe honestly, the title of this podcast needs to be, because now I'm thinking about it more, and the subject we were going to talk about, we'll leave for the next episode, but maybe the title of this needs to be Putting the Fringe Back in the Reformed. And I mean that wholeheartedly, because what I have found fascinating, Doug, is that it's kind of like when you walk through the wardrobe of Narnia, all of a sudden, the first encounter you have with talking animals, like, can you remember the first time, like, wait a minute, these animals are talking, and then what ends up happening as the story goes on? All the animals are, and it becomes normal for them. So it went from one experience of like, oh, this beaver is talking to me, to all the animals are talking, which I love though. It was the Don Treader when the birds, they don't talk. And Eustace is like, well, how am I supposed to know that birds don't talk? Everything talks in here. Mm-hmm. But what I am realizing is that now that I've opened my heart and my mind to want to embrace this, that we are far, 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 far away from the first to discover these things and embrace these things. And the Reformed, this is why I'm saying putting the fringe back in the Reformed. You know, Doug, there's a famous hymn that we sing all the time, especially during the Reformation, from Martin Luther, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." I mean, have you ever paid attention to those words? It's crazy, where you are literally singing about the devil trying to destroy us and infiltrate us and pull us from our faith. Just go through and read that hymn. I dare you. What you're going to realize is that, I mean, everybody already knew Luther is throwing his inkwell at Satan and having all kinds of conversations with him. And I don't think that needs to be lost on us. I've been reading, believe it or not, I've been reading Cotton Mather's book. Are you ready for this? It's on witchcraft, the Dover occult.
Oh yeah.
And there's this quote by Cotton Mather that I just want to read as I was reading through this. He says, "I am very persuaded that there are very few human affairs wherein some devils are not insinuated. There is not so much a journey intended, but Satan will have a hand in hindering or furthering of it." Now, that is a absolutely fascinating quote coming from Cotton Mather. If you don't know who Cotton Mather is, you should do your homework on it. pretty famous author. But as you start walking down the trail of the Reformed faith, you realize that guys like B.B. Warfield, who had a whole section on the supernatural, I think that there has been times where we've gone in and out and the Reformers are throwing their hands up going, what happened to the supernatural nature of our faith? Let's bring this back. We need to have this. You and I had mentioned recently how I think the Puritan movement felt this, where we got away from the supernatural and got back into the physical realm of like trying to do everything from a physical realm. So I would say the heartbeat of our podcast is, one, we want to open up the floodgates and say, yeah, our world is definitely supernatural. Like, whether you want to tip the hat to that, we want to actually press into that and say, no, I think you need to see it in that way. And we don't think it's a free-for-all. Doug and I don't think you should do this just as a free-for-all. I think you need to have a spiritual grounding, and that's the Reform. This is why we named it Reform French. So I think it's a legitimate conversation. And speaking of, I'll throw this in the advertisement before we go on. One of the things that Doug and I have realized early on is that there are a lot of people who are listening to what we're saying, but yet want to have conversations, and they want to make sure that they can ask questions and post articles and often even see dialogues, maybe even hop on a video phone call or a video chat. We started something, which is where the podcast got its name, called the Reform French. And it's growing. There's over 100 people in there now, and it has all kinds of pastors, missionaries, laymen, professors, theologians. It's been a great place. And so if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, man, this is amazing, and there's a place for you. If you're a pastor or a missionary and you can't afford it, please reach out to us. We'll get you in there for free. We're just trying to pay for this thing. Actually costs money for us to have. So we're just trying to pay for it. So we'd love to have you guys in there. Tons of resources, lots of articles, lots of books, live interaction. So just wanted to throw that out there as an advertisement to kind of our first initial Reform Fringe podcast into the Reform Fringe community, as Doug likes to call it. Not a safe place, but a haven.
Yeah, the Reformed Fringe, well, not the, but reformfringe.com is the way that you can find it. And, you know, how many people have we run across that just say that they feel like they're not, you know, they've kind of somehow, usually through a podcast or through a book or mm-hmm. something like that, they've started investigating the stranger things in the world. And they're like, especially in the reformed world, they feel like they don't have anybody that they can talk to. They feel alone. And that's one of the reasons why we started it, is not only so that people wouldn't feel alone, but so that they can see that, in fact, they are not alone. And there's entire groups of people that are talking about this, even in our circles, which is exciting for us, because
it's huge
to be able to get in and interact with some of the people that are on the cutting edge thinking about these things, or even just people that are in churches that are having experiences that they would never tell you about. And all of a sudden they start talking about those kinds of things. I mean, this is a needed platform for people. So we're very happy to be able to provide it.
Absolutely. Doug, I don't know if we want to go down this route, but maybe we will just for a moment. Sometimes when people find your writings, some people find you through Blurry Creatures or some other podcast, or I know there are people who are searching for things and your book has popped up. I know that that's happened recently. People were looking for something on YouTube and our episodes popped up. And what can happen, though, is that like the superstitious conspiracy theory, fringe, charismatic world is over here. And on the other side of the canyon is Reformed theology, and the two shall not pass. And and it's unfortunate. And so what I want to do is just take a moment and help people understand that Doug and I aren't trying to do something novel here. We're not like, oh, like, okay, so the conspiracy world is really on the rage right now. The government is unlocking all this stuff. And so John and Doug are trying to be clever and kind of hop on that bandwagon. Not interested in that. That doesn't mean we're not interested in those conversations, but we're not trying to be clever. We're pastors who take our faith serious. And for our defense, what I want to do for a moment here is walk through history and help people understand that there have been sound, reformed theologians who are confessional, who have been educated, seminary grads, who have had well-documented public ministry. So these aren't guys that like fell off the rails because they found the supernatural and all of a sudden, you know, they became occultists or something like that, which is what is making sound. It's as if you try and promote what Doug and I are promoting, you're going to end up running off the rails. Even the accusations, Doug, I've heard recently of people saying you're going to go into Eastern Orthodoxy. Have you heard this recently?
I have not.
Yes. They're saying that, like, if you are teaching the divine council, the Genesis 6 view, that eventually that leads you into Eastern Orthodoxy. And I'm like, well,
I don't even know if the Orthodox believe that Genesis 6 is a Nephilim thing, because they lost their history on this the same time that Rome did. In fact, it was Ephraim the Syrian who was kind of the first guy to desupernaturalize the text. So
yeah, but aren't they the ones that have the book of Enoch in there? Or am I thinking of the
Ethiopian right. Church. Yep,
that's right. Coptic. Yep.
So I guess we'll all become Coptics, I guess.
One day, whatever. Anyways, moving on. I want to start with some modern reform guys and kind of start walking the history back. It's not going to be academic, but some of these names will be familiar to you. I think it's healthy and good for you to hear them as we walk them back. And I'll just start with you, Doug, but you wrote a book, a co-authored a book with, and this is a book that I want to promote. We're going to start promoting books in the beginning of our episode. So called The Angel of the Lord. And the reason I want you to get it now and start reading it, because Doug and I are going to be doing episodes on it soon. But Doug, you wrote a book with Matt Foreman. So you both are theologically trained seminary grads. Matt Foreman, just to point this out, is probably trained in my opinion, in one of the most famous popular seminaries at the time right now, which is Westminster. And so you have a Westminster grad and a pastor who's been faithfully teaching his church for 20 years, Reformed confessional, a part of a Reformed confessional network called the Reformed Baptist Network, right? Who those who have read your book did not seem deemed to kick you out of the network because you're teaching heresy. Not only that, but endorsed your book along with men like, so you have a book, Angel of the Lord, and inside that chapter 11 is a full explanation of the divine counsel. Is this correct?
Yeah, yeah.
So it would be an agreement of how Michael Heiser, not a full agreement, everything he taught in his book, but how he taught, like his understanding of the divine counsel. Is that fair?
Right. I mean, the divine counsel is not something Mike made up. You can go to any good Bible dictionary and they will be talking about that. Right. So
that's my point. Getting to that. Yeah. So you've got Vody Bachum who promoted the book. You got multiple guys in the network. Bat Foreman as an author on it. But let's go to some other modern Reformed Baptist. You have Craig Carter. Craig Carter also recently wrote a book on the Trinity, and I think it's a fascinating book. I would completely recommend for you to get it. Let me pull it up so I quote it correctly. So it's called Contemplating God with the Great Traditions, Recovering Trinitarian Classic Theism. Carl Truman, who is also a well-known Reformed, wrote the foreword to the book. Matthew Barrett also recommended it, wrote a review inside his book, and has it on his website. And inside of this, there's an entire chapter about the divine counsel. So you have Craig Carter is a Baptist, lives in Canada. You have two men who are well-respected within the Reformed world who are recommending this book. A Reformed Anglican, by the way, I think this next one is very important, Doug. This is gonna, this next book is by a Reformed Anglican. His name is Gerald McDermott. Now, Gerald wrote his book in 2007. How many years is that before Michael Heiser wrote his book?
Yeah, 10 years. And then, I'm trying to think of when Mike published his dissertation because it was maybe the same year. So McDermott wouldn't have even had access to anything that Heiser had done.
Nope. As a matter of fact, someone read the McDermott book and years later told Michael about it. So the name of the book is God's Rivals, Why Has God Allowed Different Religions, Insights from the Bible and the Early Church.
Yeah, really good book.
It's a great book. And one of my top recommended books, just from understanding, I mean, the topic is he did a brilliant job. The guy is dripping with his understanding of appropriate view of the gospel. It's so good. But he has a whole chapter on there on the Heavenly Host, the Divine Counsel. And never once mentions Heiser because Heiser wasn't even on his radar. And then has, I think, the best chapter in the book is how Paul uses the principalities and the powers, how Paul uses the divine counsel and his fight against the fallen divine counsel in the New Testament. It's so great. It's just a great chapter. But another example, let's keep going back in history. You have men such as James Montgomery Boyce, who held a full understanding of Genesis 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean so much so that at the end of his explanation, he says that, and it's so brilliant, he says that God is preserving humanity by wiping it out because Satan and his minions were trying to corrupt all of humanity. And only Noah and his family had remained not spiritually pure, but physically pure. This is Boyce. If you don't know who Boyce is, please look up James Montgomery Boyce. What a brilliant author. What a brilliant pastor. On top of this, you have Donald Gray Barnhouse, who also would have had he wrote a book called The Invisible War. He held to Genesis 6 as the same as Boyce did. A.W. Pink would also, I'm just trying to give you some modern, but you can keep going down and I could keep creating a list. Now, Doug, I'm going to hop in here so people don't get angry with me. Would we say that it's a 50-50 split right down the middle that 50% of the Reform held it, 50 didn't? No, I wouldn't say that. But I would say good, prominent men who we love and trust did hold this view. And therefore, it is not anti-confessional. It is not driven by some kind of weird mysticism. It's not driven by a wrong hermeneutic. I want to jump in here, Doug. People have been accusing us of embracing an improper Reformed hermeneutic to come to these conclusions. And my point in showing you that you, Matt Foreman, that Craig Carter I mean, all of these men who have held to either the divine counsel view or a Genesis 6 view held to a reformed hermeneutic and still came to these conclusions.
So what do you mean by the word hermeneutic?
Yeah. So a hermeneutic is the process of interpretation, right? It's a system of explaining scripture. Everyone has one, whether it's good or bad. No one comes to scripture what we call with an unbiased view. It's impossible to do. Something is informing your view. I'll give you an example. If someone says, I just read the Bible for what it is, and I never place any systems on the text. Okay. I go ahead and pick up the Bible and I read Genesis chapter 1. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I said, is that a Trinitarian God or not? And they always say what? Yes.
It's usually they say yes. Yeah. Yeah.
If they're Orthodox Christians, they say yes. I said, okay, that means you immediately are putting a Trinitarian system inside your reading. That's just what it means. A hermeneutic means you're taking a system of understanding and you're putting it down into the text. So what we're saying is a grammatical, historical, redemptive, or I would say more of a redemptive historic understanding of scripture is what these men are using. It's what we're using. And they're coming to the conclusion that Genesis 6 is talking about angels and that there is a divine counsel that God uses of, I dare say, Hervin Bovink in his own systematic theology says that there's a hierarchy in the angels. Well, how can that be? So this is in their language. Now, did all the reformers agree? No. Do all the modern reformers agree? No. But we can see that there are good men who
That reminds me of a quote from John Piper. I think this might be in Desiring God or it might be in The Pleasures of God, one of his earlier books. And he makes this comment. He goes, "Is something along the lines of how you're talking about a controversial subject. And of course, in that case, it's predestination.
Sure.
And then he goes, I can't think of any subject that isn't controversial with somebody. Somebody disagrees with everything somewhere, you know?
That's right.
And he goes, so what we need to do is we need to go into the marketplace and see what the other people believe and then go to the scripture and you know, have it be our base, but not be afraid of something that's controversial just because it's controversial, because in fact, everything is controversial.
That's
somebody.
That's somebody. Yeah. And Doug and I don't want to interpret scripture apart from history. We don't think that's wise. We think it's wise to, you know,
But history doesn't just begin in the 17th century.
Wait a minute. Are you sure about that?
Pretty sure about that. When I write down AD and BC, I'm pretty sure that I'm going back 2000 years. And so.
There's history before the printing press. That's fascinating.
History before Calvin and Luther, history before the Confession of Faith, history even before the Church Fathers. Believe it or not, the Church Fathers were actually reading things themselves that weren't just the Bible.
That's right. So anyways, Meredith Klein, we could throw Klein in there. If you want to go back to some of the reformers, Thomas Goodwin had a fascinating view of the supernatural. At times made some very interesting statements that are very much relevant to this.
John Owen. I did a whole book on Joe and John Owen. Actually, three different Puritans I published books on. One named Peter Alex, another named Gerard de Gaulle, and then another is from John Owen himself, the great John Owen the Puritan. And just looking at their view of just in this case, the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament and them viewing this as the second person of the Trinity. Like this was not shocking to these people, although not everybody agreed with it. It was definitely something that many people believed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you got Cotton Mather, but Cotton Mather wrote like four books on magic, witchcraft, and the supernatural. I mean, four books. That's a lot. I mean, I'm thinking one could have summed it up. He's like, nah, we're going to do four. So I think that even from the reformers, there's theology that is still developing. Like I would even say my Presbyterian brothers, whom I love, my Paedobaptist brothers, don't quite hold to Calvin's view on paedobaptism, right? So they take his views and kind of morph and shift it and develop it at times. And so all Doug and I are saying is there are some clear cut parameters about who God is, the Trinity, the gospel, the nature of God. We think that those are powerful. We want to use those. At the same time, there's still work to be done thinking through and developing the supernatural nature of our faith. And that's what this podcast is about, is to continue that tradition.
You know, in our older iteration, Kingdoms Unveiled, I think I probably brought this up maybe one time, I don't know. But I look at what we're trying to do as a bridge between two very different worlds. And you brought that up a little bit. So why do these two worlds need to bridge each other? Let me give you a good example. So when I listen to my buddies, Blurry Creatures, and then I see some of the guests, and then some of the people that are on Facebook sites and stuff like that, you know, there's a wide range of people coming theologically to talk about this kind of stuff, right? The Reformed people are very much a minority. But what I've noticed, and it's not just me that's noticing this, and it's not just Reformed people that are noticing it, Luke and Nate both noticed this. That it's like we're getting some pretty weird people that are coming here and, you know, trying to do stuff with what they're doing on their podcast through their, in some cases, really crazy, crazy theologies.
Yeah.
And I've thought forever, because I'm Reformed, that this is a great foundation that you need. So that you have, you know, you have kind of these walls that you don't want to go outside of those walls, but you have freedom within it. But when your walls are so big, or in some cases you don't have any walls because you have no theological foundation at all, you can just go out going off any old place. And so to have a foundation of Reformed theology is a great starting point. It's not the only starting point, but it's a great starting point. We think it's the best that you can have that's out there. I mean, that's just our opinion, but you know, that's what the confessions are supposed to be doing, is giving you these boundaries on essential or very, very important things to think about. But what happens when you have things that are outside of that? How do you think about that? Well, if you don't have any foundation, then you can think of it almost any way you want, and you can go in some pretty ridiculous places. If you have a foundation, then that can help you actually frame some of the things that you're thinking about, with whether it's divine counsel or Bigfoot. It doesn't really matter what it is you're thinking of, to try and be able to have a worldview that can that's already there, that you can kind of add stuff to. And that's the other part of this. So there's the one side of it that needs a foundation, but there's the other side of it. And I can speak from personal experience. I know that you can too.
Sure.
Which is that when you come to realize that the supernatural world is so much bigger than you ever thought that it was, and furthermore, when you start to see that the Holy Scripture is talking on a supernatural level that you never understood before, all of a sudden, all these scriptures that you're like, I have no idea what that means, start coming into view and focus. And you can start to make sense of what it's talking about. And the analogy that I give is, it's like going from black and white television to color, or it's like going from two dimensions to three dimensions. It's not bad to watch something in black and white. In fact, sometimes it can be interesting in and of itself, but everybody wants to watch, ordinarily speaking, television in color, right? Because it gives you the full picture. It gives you much more texture and that kind of stuff to be able to see what, to visualize what you're looking at. And this is the same thing with the supernatural. So if you've got a group of people that have kind of desupernaturalized, whether it's liberals or deists, or to a lesser degree, we think some of the Reformed world, adding that texture and color and third dimension can be such a great help for having people start to answer questions that they never thought that they would ever find answers to. And all of a sudden, it's not just one or two questions, John. It's like whole chapters of the Bible, or, you know, whole doctrines of theology that you just were like, I don't know what to. I'll give you an example. 1 Corinthians 11, you and I were talking about that this last week. It's like, I tell people in my church, I'm never going to preach on 1 Corinthians. And then all of a sudden something hit me this week that I'm like, I think I actually can maybe make sense of this in a way I never could before. But it was a, I needed a whole new way of looking at the text in order for me to kind of rethink why it is that I can't make sense heads or tails of this chapter.
Don't give it away, because we're going to do an episode on it.
Do that at some point in time. But that's just my point, though, is that, you know, everybody has parts of scripture like, I don't know what that means.
Sure.
And we want to know, and we want to be able to give good and solid answers to it. And sometimes the supernatural can be of help to that.
To your point, going back to if there isn't a foundation, and we're going to talk about this in an upcoming episode, but this is 2 Peter 3, and he's talking about Paul's letters. He says, and there are some things in them that are hard to understand, which the ignorant and unstable twist to their own destruction as they do the other scriptures. So think about what he said there. He said there are things that Paul has written that could be complicated. And if you're ignorant and you're unstable, they can get twisted, listen to this, to their own destruction. And that's, I think, what you're talking about, Doug, is that there, I think, people who have run headlong into some of these conversations, and they are ignorant of what Satan can do with the truth, and they're unstable, and it ends up hurting them. And you and I think you've even watched this, where some people get so far out there that they're actually hurting Christianity instead of helping it.
Yeah, you can see that's a great, great verse, John. So you have the unstable people, which run with it however they want to go. But then you have the ignorant people who may not be unstable at all, but because they don't know what they're talking about, they start bad-mouthing things and they make themselves look like fools, because anybody who knows what they're talking about is like, they look at it and go, what is your problem with this? You're just showing your ignorance. That's both of those things are kind of opposite problems, don't you think?
I do. And instead of like ignoring, because what ends up happening, Doug, the warning is, well, that can cause this over here, so let's ignore that. And then they'll quote another passage where Paul talks about myths and things like this. And we're like, well, we're not talking about myths from the culture. We're actually talking about the text, and we're trying to make sense of the text. And it's interesting. The amount of times, Doug, I've been warned, well, just be careful, John, because people can get really wrapped up in this stuff. And I'm like, I'm going to steal this from McDermott's book. But McDermott makes the point, Paul talks about the supernatural realm, the nefarious side of it, in every one of his letters, except for one, Philemon, is the only one he doesn't mention it. And I'm like, if Paul's mentioning it, by the way, in both Peter's letters, in Jude, in 1 John, I mean, actually in all of John's letters, and Revelation, I mean, that's just dumped full of it. There comes a moment where you say, okay, if all the New Testament letters except for Philemon are talking about this, maybe we're not the ones that got it wrong. But at the same time, we're not saying you should only focus in on the supernatural. If the supernatural is disconnected from the foundation of our faith, which is, I think, biblical doctrine, then Peter's warnings are warranted, because that's probably what was happening. In this particular section, I don't think he was dealing with supernaturalism. I think he was dealing with people who are saying you could live a central life and live however you wanted, and they were twisting Paul's words. But I think it can apply in a lot of places.
So you want a good example of this? I'm preaching on Acts 19 this week in Ephesus, Paul in Ephesus. And when I was preaching through Ephesians 6 or 7 years ago, I decided to read this chapter as kind of a part of the introduction to what we were looking at in Ephesians. And you had just brought this up, right? So Ephesians is like supercharged with principalities and powers and this present spiritual darkness and all this kind of stuff, right?
Right.
Well, the question becomes, why? So I never understood this. And here's where knowing background information can be so important. If you lived in Ephesus, you would know why. Because one of the seven great wonders of the world was there. And you want to know what that was? It was what I think it was Pausanias called the biggest building of the ancient world. And it was the temple to Artemis.
Artemis, yeah.
And in Acts 19, they're sitting here. It's a completely magical, and by that I don't put it in a good way, incantation sort of stuff. A riot ensues and they start screaming out. Almost you can imagine them in a trance. Great mm-hmm. is Artemis of the Ephesians. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So here's a quote from a scholar. He says, she may very well be the most important background for understanding why the author highlights the power of God and the corresponding powers of evil in books such as Ephesians. Why? Because this woman was, this goddess was, she had aspects of all kinds of things. She has right. aspects of Artemis, Diana, but she's not the same thing as what we normally think of with the Greeks. This goddess goes back much farther. She has aspects of Hecate, which and Sibyl, who was a goddess of magic, and she also has aspects of literally Gaia, Mother Earth. And so this the worship of this creature in this city predated the Greeks by we don't know how long, and they end up building this massive temple to her that becomes, like I said, one of the seven wonders of the world. And if Paul is talking about powers and principalities and the power of the air and darkness, who in the world do you think he has in mind? He has the goddess of this city because that's who he's talking about. And he didn't take that as, well, she's just a myth. She doesn't really exist. He said, no, we take up our spiritual weapons and we fight against those things because our God is infinitely more powerful. And in fact, I think that that's what actually Luke is doing in the first half of that story. Remember, it says that that they started bringing even handkerchiefs and aprons to Paul, hoping that if they would just touch him, they could send them back to the people. And then check this out. It says that not only does the object, like Paul's not even there. The object itself touches somebody and they're healed and demons come out of them.
That's nuts.
The very next story then becomes these Jewish itinerant preachers, the seven sons of Sceva, the high priest of the synagogue there, and they try to cast out a demon. Same exact thing. So in the case of Jesus, the power is, and it's just a touch, and it just touched an, the cloth touched Paul, and a demon comes casting out. Here you have these exorcists, and the demon goes, I knew who Jesus is and I know who Paul is. I don't have a clue who you are. And then he beats the crap out of him, right? A mockery of the powers that these people worship, but it's not saying they don't exist. It's saying that our God is infinitely more powerful than theirs is. Well, if you know the background to Ephesians, and all of a sudden you can start making a lot more sense. And that's what we're trying to say in terms of the supernatural, adding that third dimension that you can start making sense of things that never made sense before.
So you got my mind racing, you know, when, so this makes a whole lot more sense when you're thinking about Ephesians, when he says you wrestle not against flesh and blood. If you believe that humans are creating, because in that area, I mean, there's a lot of evil going on. The Christians are being persecuted. But the persecution's coming from humans, right? They're not actually engaging. Not every Christian was engaging with some kind of like actual demonic spirit. They're engaging with human, like they're being killed by other humans. And Paul is saying you have to look past the human and realize it's the power behind what they're worshiping is the source of what you're fighting,
inciting them to do what they're doing, real.
Why would that change today? It's not like, you know, here in Ephesus only. I'm going to deal with this.
I've actually heard people in our circles say, well, yeah, there are no demons anymore. That was a first century thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know where they get that from. I don't know why they would think that, but your point is spot on to me that,
well, they all ended up in the same. They ended up in the pig and they ran off the cliff. So that's why.
So they're all gone. That was the legion. It was all of them, right?
That was all of them. That's right. For me, that's been helpful too. Sometimes when people hear me say this, they're like, oh, well, then you're saying that these people are pure victims and that they shouldn't be held accountable. And I'm like, no, there is definitely Satan uses people who are willing to be used, right? And they have turned their hearts over to evil, and he then uses that for his own advantage, and I think uses it in a supernatural way. this is even the thing with what, you know, what does Peter say to Ananias and Sapphira? It's like, why did you give your heart over to Satan? Like, there was a willingness for this to happen. And so, yes, there's a willingness for them to embrace and worship these gods, but at the same time, they're also being controlled by it. And Paul says, the way in which you fight against them is you go past the physical and you have to go into the spiritual realm. And man, I'm telling you, the whole Matrix movie helps you understand that, like, you have to be able to tap into that other, like, realm in your mind. And Doug, this has been so helpful for me. You know, we mentioned this a couple episodes ago in Ephesians, where Paul talks about that God has decided to use the church to advance the wisdom of God into the heavenly places, where the rulers and the authorities, they're the ones hearing it. So, like, in many ways, as much as Satan uses the internet and the airwaves to promulgate his message, right now, the power of the gospel, as we are proclaiming the wonders of Christ, is also, like, who knows how God's using these words to push back evil around the world? By the way, there's, what we'd say, there's like 15 different countries represented in the
yeah, there are right now. Pretty wild.
Which is amazing to think about. 15 countries are being, at least one person in that country is being encouraged and equipped to proclaim the gospel in a supernatural way. And that's, you know, and who knows how many people around the world listen to the podcast. I don't really know. I could look into that at some point. But for me, I get excited about that. I think it has greater implications about how we govern our homes, how we govern our lives, thinking about the importance of the church. I think a greater understanding of the supernatural, ecclesiology, the purpose of the church, just goes to a whole another level. I mean, go back to the series that you and I did on the ordinary means of grace, the preaching and the sacraments of baptism. Doug and I full on believe that preaching, baptism, and the sacraments and singing and fellowship are all spiritual warfare. They're all weapons for defense, for refreshing, and for advancement.
Yeah.
And so offense. It changes. Yeah. Changes how you look at church. It's not there for funsies.
It's funny. I think Jesus said something like, the gates of hell will not prevail against my church. One would think that that would be spiritual warfare against supernatural evil. And that's an offensive image, by the way, because the church is not the one with the gates and the walls. Hell is what has the gates and the walls. And the church storms the gates of hell. And captives that are inside of those gates that have long been there because they were born into captivity to Satan himself. Ephesians 2:1 and 2 and 3, power, you know, dead in your trespasses and sins, underneath the power of the prince of the air and darkness, the gospel sets them free and liberates them from this supernatural captivity that they were born into.
Dude, what an image. Dude, I've got the chills right now. What an image. He's talking to the disciples, and he's about to send them into the gates. He goes, listen, I got the authority. Don't worry. Because some of these guys have seen, like, demonic things happening, and they're like, man, I don't know if I want to mess with that realm. And Jesus says, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth, and I'm going to send you into the gates, and you're going to proclaim the power of the gospel, and it's through the power of the gospel that you will set them free. And later on, Paul has to come back and go, hey guys, just remember, as we're in the gates, don't stand in your own strength, because you're right in the middle. The church has been, because you think about it, where did the apostles plant the church? Inside the gates. And where are the gates? It's in the world. I mean, the imagery is so beautiful. So he's like, by the way, if you try and stand in your own strength while we're in these gates, you're going to get knocked over by the arrows that are shooting everywhere. So stand in the strength of the Lord, put on the full armor of Christ. I mean, this imagery is not lost. But it's not lost to us, but it's been lost to the world. And it's kind of like fun or flowery or just completely disconnected. But to us, we think it's legit. Like, we're inside the gate storming right now, and we're failing at times.
You know, it's funny. God's Jesus, not failing. Jesus gave the that speech while they're at the bottom of Caesarea Philippi at the base of Mount Hermon. Then he immediately goes up and is transfigured on top of Mount Hermon. Well, what happens right after that in Luke's gospel? It says, this is Luke 10, and it says that after this, the Lord appointed 70 others and sent them on ahead, 2 by 2, into every town and place where he himself was about to go. So they go off into Samaria, but how many of them? There's that 70. Magic number. It's the number 70, because it's the number of the divine council. Then in verse 17, the 70 return with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And Jesus says to them, I know, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. And when was that? Well, my opinion is, we could do a whole show on this, it was at the Transfiguration. Behold, I have given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions. And guys, that's not talking about reptiles in the desert. Serpents.
To our snake handling Baptist.
Genesis chapter 3, folks. Serpents. Scorpions. Over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall hurt you. And then I love the way he ends it. Nevertheless. And so that was kind of the fringy part. Here's the reform part. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven, because I am the one who has the power over these things. Don't you ever think that you are one of the sons of Sceva, because guess what will happen to you if you do?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, and that's what he says. Look, it's more important and more impressive to look at my love and the gospel. The fact that you're a part of my family and my kingdom is far more important than you bossing around demons. Because for all of eternity, we're going to, right? So this is a little bit of work to do. Anyways, this podcast has gotten on to 50 minutes, so we're gonna crank her down. But hopefully you're hearing where this podcast is going. If this is your first time listening, someone shared it to you because we titled it Putting the Fringe Back in the Reform. Hope you can hear where we're going. This is all about the glory of Christ, the power of the gospel. As the church storms the gates, we really believe this. Like, we don't think Jesus was, you know, speaking in language that, I mean, what did he mean by that? Like, you yourself need to answer that question. What does Jesus mean? What does Paul mean when he says you don't wrestle against flesh and blood? You need to stand in the strength of the Lord. What does Peter mean when he says, be sober-minded, the Satan wants to destroy you? What does James mean when he says, resist the devil and he will flee from you? All of these have meaning. They're not just randomly put in there. Every New Testament letter speaks of it. And I would argue, if you go back to the Old Testament, it sets it up. In my opinion, the Old Testament, it's Narnia. The New Testament, it's like, how did we get here? The New Testament is how it all plays out in reality. So anyways, we'll just kind of throw that back there. It could have been a bad illustration, but I think you get my point. All the colors get put in place for us. Speaking of, unless the Lord, he directs our paths, our goal in our next episode is to talk about why does the spiritual realm work the way it does? Like, if God, why can't God just kind of bind up all the evil and then go out and save humans? Like, why are we still wrestling with this concept of the evil realm? And Doug and I are going to look at that from really the perspective of 2 Peter chapter 3. Peter is writing to these beloved people who are getting bombarded by evil. And Peter, as a great pastor, has some explanations for them. So we're going to look at that if you guys want to come back next week. And why is it still at work? So come back and we'll talk about that. Well, Doug, that's Reform Fringe introduction. I think it's
Reform
pretty good.
Fringe, yeah, Reform Fringe introduction. Thanks, everyone, for tuning into the show. And we do indeed hope you come back many, many, many times.